Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times, a science and speculative fiction podcast. Short stories to stir the imagination by contemporary authors.
City of Joy by Weston Oakes. Read by Jean-Paul L. Garnier, with music by Fog Machine. City of Joy. Puff the Magic Dragon lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Hanalei. Peter, Paul, and Mary, 1963. No vids, no access to the learned verse, no friends, no sim time, no fun. Sally Mae Coleridge ruminated in her own 15-year-old self-pity as the glow train took her to the City of Joy. Besides her, the vid screen, which initially had shown the browns and blacks of scorched earth and the flattened desolation of Florida, now showed the way life used to be at the place they once called Disney World. Thousands of children and adults, dressed in non-uniform clothing, running happily amok through the park, taking rides, eating food, and laughing with all the curious fidelities of happiness. First opened in October of 1971, Disney World and its four parks were once the world's most visited recreational resort, the monotone voice of the vid's narrator said. An old map showed the park, poised between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans in the center of Florida. I remember when my father took me to Epcot Center, her father had said when they first boarded the train. The Tomorrow Room showed us what the future would look like. I was so inspired by the possibilities, and although none of that really happened, I can still feel the hope I felt when I first saw what might be. I never went, but my cousin did, her mother had said. She used to rave about Magic Mountain and the Magic Dragon rides. She always used to say that it was the only time in the world she was at once terrified and filled with joy at the same time. Sally heard it all but pretended not to listen. She didn't want to go. She didn't want to lose her hair like everyone did when they returned. She didn't want people to know that she'd even gone. If she had the choice and opportunity, she'd hide until it was all over. Might as well get out of the funk, young lady, her mother had said, poking her in the shoulder. We're doing this for you, and you should appreciate it. But I don't want you to do this for me, Sally said. You're too young to know what you want. Your father and I want you to see what the learned verse won't teach you and what the Sims won't show. I've accessed all the information, Mom. What good will it do me to go there? There's something to be said for actually going someplace and experiencing it. But do I have to lose my hair in the process? Some would wish that that was the only thing they'd lose. And why do they call it the City of Joy? Why not the old name? The new name reflects what it has become. In truth, it really doesn't have a name anymore. People just call it that. Besides, Disney Corporation no longer owns it. That conversation had been an hour ago. Sally didn't buy it, but she was unable to do anything about it. She stewed in her fugue until another girl slid next to her and introduced herself. My name's Amy Judd. I'm from Arkansas, Argo. Who are you? Sally tried to act sullen, but one look at the dark circles under the new girl's eyes, the sallow complexion, and the already bald head told her much about who Amy Judd from Arkansas Argo might be. Sally Coleridge from Denver Metro, she said with as much verb as she could muster. You don't want to be here, do you? Whatever gave that away? It's all over your face. You look eternally sad. Doesn't everyone who comes here? Sally didn't hear an answer and eventually looked at Amy. Instead of a frown, a smile beamed from Amy's wan face. Don't tell me you like it. Like it? This is the best thing that's ever happened to me. Sally examined the other girl more closely. She was an Argonaut whose life was meant to be spent in the Neutro swamps of the Arkansas plains. Hers was destined to be a hard life. No sim time. Days spent under the swamps or floating on the harvest barge. If she'd been born into a metro, things would have been different for her. She'd have been more like Sally. But she hadn't been. She was an Argo. But aren't you worried about the radiation? My Learnverse mates tell me it can cause all sorts of defects. I'm not worried about the defects. For the first time, the girl frowned. Sally looked around at the others as if for the first time. There were several unlucky kids like her, but there were also lots of adults. Some looked hale and healthy like her parents, but there were quite a few elderly, someone's grams and gramps. Then, there were some like Amy, their bald heads giving them away, like beacons of ill health riding above the seats. A hum sounded as the train began to slow. They were due to change trains, but not before the showers. Sally screamed as the orange water hit her, from every direction at once. It shot into her pores and private places. The soap that made the water orange smelled sickly sweet. They said it killed all germs, thus eliminating the chance of a superbug being created in the radioactive areas. Sally couldn't care less. It felt as if the hot water was lacerating her, and she couldn't wait for it to end. All of this because of a hurricane. Hurricane Uma, to be exact. No one had known about the RBMK-1000 reactor Fidel Castro had built in the Cuban jungle until it blew. The same model as those at Chernobyl, the Soviet Union built a nuclear reactor in Cuba during the height of the Cold War. But the war ended, as did Castro. And it wasn't a dozen years later when the reactor suffered a meltdown, its outdated components mismanaged by undereducated technicians. The radiation might have been localized had it not been for Hurricane Uma, which passed over the island, scooping up the radiation and pushing it forward, as a communal gesture to Cuba's fraternal nemesis, America. When she slid onto the seat of the clean train, her pout was full on. Her skin throbbed. They made her wear a red pantsuit, the shirt short-sleeved and awful. She ran the fingers of her right hand through her hair as she stared at the vid screen. It showed Florida as it had been. Trees, swamp, the occasional alligator, roads, combustion cars, buildings, people, life. So much had changed. In some ways, Florida now was no different than the rest of the world. Global crisis, metabugs, economicides. Gone was the way of the 20th century. Sally touched the bottom edge of the vid screen and watched as it flipped to now. The ground was brown and green, prime real estate returning to swamp. Here and there, black scorched earth marred the landscape like scars, melted metal and glass from additional nuclear strikes by US-fired missiles, a coup de grace to the eternally wounded land of Florida. She touched the screen again, and it superimposed a ghostly image of the past onto the present. Only then did she realize the totality of the devastation and loss. "Can I do that?" Amy Judd slid next to Sally. She wore a yellow pantsuit that looked ghastly. Sally gestured to the window as if to say, "Be my guest." "No, not that." Amy lowered her head and blushed. When she looked up, she wore an embarrassed smile. "That." Amy pointed at Sally's hand as she repeatedly pulled it through the lustrous long hair. Sally stared at the other girl's baldness. She didn't want the girl to touch her at all. But a spark of humanity ignited within her. And as it grew, so did Sally's desire to make the other girl feel better. After all, she was going to die. Sally nodded. Amy quickly reached for the hair, but stopped before she could touch it. She seemed to gather herself, then slowly let her fingertips caress Sally's hair. She pulled her hand through several times. It wasn't long before tears came into her eyes. She removed her hand, wiped her eyes with the back of one hand, then dropped her hands to her lap, where they trembled with the memory of the touch. "Thanks," she murmured. Sally found herself staring at the other girl's hands, so much like her own, yet they were so different. While Sally grew up in Metro with skyscrapers and solar bunkers, Amy's life was spent in an agro. Was it the fertilizer that had given her cancer? Sally wondered, or was it the solar radiation? The nails on the girl's hands were ragged, broken, as if she chewed them or raked them against something hard. Sally had never broken a nail. Her hands were as soft as the skin of her thigh. "You girls going to do the park together?" Sally's mom asked. She approached from the head of the train car. She wore a red pantsuit like Sally's. The girls exchanged glances. Sally opened her mouth to answer, but noticed a bald woman staring at them. Instead, she changed the conversation. "Didn't your aunt come here once and ride Magic Dragon?" "It was my cousin," Sally's mom said. Then she laughed. She placed a hand on the back of the seat. Sally noticed that her mother's nails were like her own, perfect and unblemished. She thought it was going to be like the old movie, but it was nothing like the purple cartoon dragon. Rather, it was a furious contraption made from steel girders and red elastic facing. "Purple cartoon dragon?" Amy asked. "Popular 20th century two-dimensional cinematic icon that promoted drug use," Sally replied. She'd accessed the Learn Verse earlier and had a tag waiting for just this sort of question. "Oh," Amy said, blank-faced. "And it's a ride?" "Not just a ride," Sally's mother said. "It's a roller coaster." "We aren't going to have to ride it, are we?" Sally asked. "So dramatic," her mother sighed. Then she looked forlornly at Amy, who refused to meet the older woman's eyes and shook her head. "We can't ride that one, honey. Magic Dragon is a special ride for special people." Amy looked and held Sally's gaze for a long moment, making it clear that she was one of the special people for which the ride was made. Sally turned away, changing the subject. "Why Joy, Mom? Why do they call it the City of Joy? I mean, it's an amusement park surrounded by a radioactive wasteland. Where's the joy?" "Joy comes in all forms. Your joy may not be the same as someone else's. It all depends on what you are trying to possess, what you have to gain. I suppose joy is the feeling you get when you attain that which you most desire." "I want to possess my hair." Sally pursed her lips. "Sally, look around. Don't you think they do too? Where's your decorum?" Sally didn't have to look to be reminded of all the bald people. Her mother would disabuse her of her desire to keep her hair, but it was a hard thing for Sally to ignore. Her hair was, after all, an integral part of who she was. "Sorry, Mom." She almost meant it. She and Amy sat side by side for the rest of the ride. Sally found herself increasingly thinking about her new friend. Sally had Sims and LearnVerse mates. She was very popular in some circles, especially Geography Click 214 and the Red Zone's 18th Century Trivia Room. Her avatar had won several awards and was viewed by first learners as if she was some angelic figure. She never really considered having someone real to talk to, but the proximity of the girl stirred something within her. "You're not perfect." As soon as the words left her mouth, Sally was horrified she'd said them. Amy examined Sally and replied, "Neither are you." "I didn't mean..." "That's okay. You're Metro. Dad says that you guys are barely human anymore. He says you've been computerized." Sally glared at Amy, then burst into laughter. "Computerized?" "Yep." "Where are your parents?" "They couldn't leave the aggro. Blue algae season started last week." "And they let you come here alone?" "Why not? Is it dangerous?" Amy laughed. Before Sally could respond, a hum sounded. The train slowed. They'd arrived. They left the train single file. For the first time, Sally breathed the air of Florida, and as she did so, she knew that it was getting inside of her, changing her, killing parts of her. The very air was deadly, laced with invisible radiation. Soon she'd lose her hair. She'd have to be bald for a while, like Amy and the others. It would take a long time to grow back. Sometimes she heard it didn't grow back at all. Whatever happened, her avatar would be her eyes and ears to the verse until she was back to normal. Sally thought she felt her skin tingling, but she'd heard that it was all in her mind. The amusement park rose out of the dusk. Night was falling, the sky red and yellow with purple hues. The rides, especially both roller coasters, were studded with lights. Sally felt a tinge of excitement upon seeing the sheer size of the roller coasters. She knew that one was Magic Mountain, and the other was Magic Dragon, but which? Water was everywhere. It glowed a bright green from the radiation-spawned algae. Larger-than-life robotic animalifications roamed the concourse. Colorful and cheerful, they were a bit scary. Her parents invited Amy to spend her time with them. Sally didn't really understand why, but didn't see the harm. Soon they were spinning around in teacups, riding a boat down a thin river with attacking robotic hippos and alligators, and herky-jerky up and down on giant mechanical arms. In between rides, they walked along the concourse. Robotic giant mice with elephantine black ears ran to and fro, trying to hug every child they could find. When they came to Sally, she closed her eyes and gritted her teeth, understanding why the girl walking in front of them broke into tears when it happened to her. They didn't eat or drink anything, as was the rule, but they did spend some time in the Smell Museum. Both Sally and Amy loved the smell of something called pepperoni pizza. They couldn't decide if they liked the hot dog with mustard, relish, and ketchup, but found themselves oddly drawn to it. The most interesting was the smell labeled Ambient Pollution 2015. They gagged from the stench. Unbelievably, this was how the air smelled like back then. The last smell was the best, and was promised to have been a yesteryear staple of amusement parks. They called it cotton candy, and the merest whiff made the girls grin from ear to ear. They ran back to it several times before Sally's parents convinced them to move on. Finally, it was time to go. The time had passed far more quickly than Sally would have thought. Amy, from Arkansas Agro, had a practical side that made her the perfect foil for Sally's jokes. By the time they'd left the cotton candy, they were walking hand in hand. Sally's mother had defined joy as that feeling you get when you attain that which you most desire. At the time, all Sally could think of was her own hair, but gone were all thoughts of her long locks, replaced by the happiness of being in the moment with Amy. She hadn't really known what she most desired until she had it. Their differences aside, they were both girls whose daring understanding of the qualities of life created a bond that had cemented over the course of 2 hours. But then the bell rang, announcing it was time for everyone to return to the train. Sally felt a tug on her arm. Amy refused to go. "Come on, you can't stay here, silly." Amy smiled, then frowned, then smiled again. "Of course I can." She tried to pull away, but Sally gripped harder. "Now look who's being silly," Amy said. Sally noticed that those wearing yellow weren't making any move towards the train. In fact, many of them were turning around and heading towards the Magic Dragon. Sally, her parents, and Amy had ridden Magic Mountain 4 times and had felt their hearts leap and dance inside their throats. She'd reached such heights of joy, she felt her smile would never go away. But it did. "Mom, tell Amy to stop playing around. Tell her it's time to go." A group of bald, yellow-suited women staring at her, their whispers lost in the sound of the train's alarm. They pointed at Sally, gathering like a conspiracy of crows. Sally wanted to scream for them to stop staring at her, but she couldn't make her mouth work anymore. Her throat ached with the effort. Soon, her mother had her by the arm and was pulling her away from Amy, the park, and the joy she'd so recently felt. When she was in her seat and the door was shut, Sally realized that Amy wasn't ever coming back. She realized that Amy had come here to stay. Sally took the orange water with a lot more bravery than when she'd arrived. She'd never thought to ask about the colors of the suits. She'd never thought about not coming back. The orange water cleaned the radiation away, but it could never remove the memory of the little bald girl in the yellow pantsuit, who did nothing more than be her friend. They'd shared cotton candy smells. They'd shared teacup rides. They'd even shared laughter as her mother had broken into song about Puff the Magic Dragon and the stupid lyrics about little boys, imagination, and the land of Honalee. In a moment of epiphany, Sally realized that the City of Joy wasn't named for the living. All along, it had been a place for the dying. The joy Amy had found was because of Sally and her parents. The girl wasn't alone her last day. She'd spent it with friends. Sally felt a spark of delight in that knowledge, perhaps the first grain of happiness that would eventually fill in the emptiness in her chest. Sally ran her fingers through her hair. as she always did when she was nervous. Only this time, strands came away with her fingers. Her hair was starting to go. Soon, she'd be like Amy. But instead of a death warrant, her bald head was more of a souvenir of the experience. Sally wondered if she'd look pretty with no hair. She wondered if she'd look like Amy. She wondered if she might just make her avatar appear the same. She sat back and remembered her last glimpse of the City of Joy, just before the train had pulled away, heading back towards civilization. Sally had keyed the vid screen to life. She'd watched the line of yellow-suited people as they'd snaked towards the magic dragon. She searched the crowd, hoping to see her friend one last time. Eventually, she spied her, two teeny arms raised in rapture as the cars carried the sick and damned through the twist and loops of the roller coaster, onward, upward, and downward, and on past joy to forever. Terraformist by Jean-Paul L. Garnier, read by Zara Khan, with music by Loop Pool.
Terraformist. We are about to breach the atmosphere. Prepare the extremophile sprayers, said Gardner. Pearson looked through the cockpit window and saw the yellow outer layers rushing toward the ship. The simulators hadn't come close to the real experience. She had been through the simulation hundreds of times, but now this was the real Venus. The sprayers were relatively easy to operate. It was the pressure of the situation that was difficult. Pressure was one thing that the simulators could not simulate. Gardner repeated the order. The reply came through her headset clearly. All systems go. The next maneuver needed to be delicate, an aero-braking procedure. One last orbit, and then the sprayers. Gardner needed to guide the craft into the upper atmosphere so that the extremophiles could be released. Then the rest was up to evolution. Venus could be a new Eden for their bacteria cargo. Gardner looked back and made eye contact with Pearson. Both of their faces wore the same expression. Concern. Gardner gathered herself and ran through the sequences that would slow their entry speed. Violent rumbling filled the cockpit. The sudden force of gravity returning pulled them into their seats. The sound of the entry ripped through their ears despite the headsets. For a moment, it felt like the ship would tear itself into two. Then the sound stopped. The spacecraft plunged back out of the atmosphere and into the vacuum of space. Looks like we lost the desired momentum. Aerobraking successful. How about that bumpy ride? Said Gardner, voice filled with relief. One of the most dangerous parts was over. Enjoy the ride for a moment. One more orbit, then it's deployment time. Both members of the crew took in the view. Details of the cloud tops gently floated below them. At the reduced speed, it looked like a different planet, serene and majestic. An almost virgin place. They could practically feel a primordial Earth waiting to be born below the clouds, nearly an endless food supply for the vast hordes of microscopic crew members in the sprayers. It's too bad we could never live long enough to see how this mission pans out, said Pearson. We may be the last to see Venus look like this up close before it changes. The gravity of this statement stalled Gardner. The remainder of the orbit before the deployment coordinates would take another 38 minutes. Until then, nothing to do but read the dials and take in the view. The sight of the cloud cover began to mesmerize her. Never had she seen such beauty. She looked back at Pearson to see if she was experiencing the same awe. If she was, Gardner couldn't tell. Pearson was busy with the preparation for the sprayers. I don't think we should do this, Pearson. Gardner's grave voice came through the headset. What are you talking about? Seeding this planet with the extremophiles is the only reason that we are here. We'd be court-martialed if we didn't complete the mission on purpose. Pearson's voice was filled with trepidation. As you said, we won't live long enough to see the outcome of this experiment. It seemed like a good idea before we were looking down on this place. What right do we have to change this planet? Maybe the seeds of life are already here and we are interfering. No one has even walked on the surface. Why are we so sure? I'm getting us out of here, replied Gardner. Pearson looked at the dials and saw that they were approaching the predetermined spraying point. She readied the controls and began the procedure. At the same moment, the craft reared out of orbit. The hiss of the sprayers filled the cabin. Out of the window, both could see the freezing cloud of their once living cargo.
An Asteroid for All by Brent A. Harris. Read by the author, with music by Red, Blue, Black, Silver.
An Asteroid for All. When you are dead, knowledge of the cosmos comes easy. The gas giant beyond our asteroid had risen to its zenith, bathing white rock in soft luminescence unmarred by shadow. At this hour, I take to walking. It is a time where I can gather my thoughts, breathe deep the thin air undetectable to most life in the galaxy, and lord over the creatures that crept and crawled under my leathery, clawed foot. Our asteroid was large enough to have its own atmosphere and gravitational pull, but smaller than most moons, and of a size where we had carved out our dominance among the subspecies which dared to dwell with us. Where I walked was busy, but only with beings beneath me. I stepped where I wished, tolerating only the pink blooms of some flowering moon bushes lining the walk. I ignored the sickly, sweet smell of the flowers as I came upon a single black speck on the ground. The speck was an ant-like creature, a parvus. They are scaly, small, with six legs, thick mandibles, sturdy enough to carve through rock, and thick, glassy eyes on stalks raised above its ugly round head. There were more of them on this asteroid than there were of us, but they were insignificant insects, and we were Amonis. I raised my clawed, three-toed foot, scaled and tufted, and gave no further thought to the creature as it crunched beneath me. It should have been the end of it. The creature was no winged warrior. When I was a hatchling, my father had abandoned me, as was our custom. I was of the age where I understood the concept. I was to wander away, to forge my own path. He granted me the rite of passage name of Folliscan, and bade me goodbye. As he turned to trudge away, leaving me in a rock-strewn meadow of flower and abandonment, I felled my father. I ran after him, tears streaming wetly down my face. A loud wailing that I did not recognize as my own echoed along the empty valley as I chased after him. My clawed feet were not as tough as they are now, and I stumbled through a field of flowers. I'm not sure if I stepped on that winged warrior's stinger or if it attacked me, but if my father had not returned to fetch my purpleless and swollen body and taken me to a healer, then I would have died as a child, even if my life, my failure, brought shame down on us all. Back on the path, I raised my foot, and the creature that I had crushed came with it. Half its body was smeared on my claw, the other half was flailing, little legs kicking in the air, eyes swinging wildly atop their stalks, pincers wide in what might have been a silent scream. I shrugged giant gray shoulders, as if they could feel pain anyway. Nevertheless, I brought my foot back down to finish the job. The insect flattened, ground into the grooves of the ground, and I carried on, until I found another one. It became like a game. The gas giant glowed softly. The flowered fragrance no longer cloyed my nose. I was bathed in the pure light. I found each parvus, asserted my dominance, and stomped. I continued along in this manner for what seemed an age. I came to yet another black speck on an otherwise spotless white walk, and once more raised my foot, a bent smile affixed to my skeletal visage. And then my smile slipped off my face, the skin above my white eyes wrinkled in confusion, and I hunched down, nearly on all fours, so that I could better examine the microscopic miracle unfurling before me. The little black parvus raised itself up on its hind legs as if it were standing in defiance of me. That was not the natural order of things. I should have pressed down, squelched my claws from side to side, and killed this creature quick. That would have stopped the game. But I was granted a curious mind, a vastly superior mind, one in which I was to lord over all, and this brave little bug intrigued me. I kept my foot up in the air. Another black insect skittered out from a hole in the rock toward the shadow of my foot, and then another. But this last parvis was red, where the others were black. There were parvi aplenty out here among the deep pits of sky and stars. They kept to themselves in their own holes, in their own tribes, and underneath the feet of our rule. Except for these three, who all stood there in insolence. I almost stepped on them, just containing my chuckle. More parvi poured over the walk. Red, brown, black, small, big, queens on milky wings, some with only five legs, others with bent backs. Many had terrifyingly large mandibles. Fewer held no discernible threats at all. Everywhere there were parvi, lower creatures, all around. They streamed out of holes and burrows until the walk was thick and dark, wriggling and writhing and swirling underfoot. I stood there, amused, until my leg began to feel fatigued. I could not hold my mirth or my foot any longer. I let it fall to the ground with a crunch. Even with our lightened gravity, the effect was deadly. The creatures could not have felt a thing. Their deaths were swift. It was as if I had stepped on seashells along the shore on some watery world. It was a cracking, brittle feeling, followed by a soft, slimy soup as liquefied innards oozed around my claws. So much death with so little effort. All of them beneath me. The sunlight shifted off our gas giant. Its light began to retract as if sucked down the horizon as day broke into blackness. I didn't notice the first insect crawl onto my foot. The walk was swarming with them, and the little buds that I hadn't stomped into oblivion were now skittering in moss along my leg. I gasped at the realization. They were on me. I raised my leg once more, leaving a sucking sound as my foot pulled away from so many oozing carcasses, so that I could reach down to wipe the invaders away with long, bony fingers. A pinch ripped into my leg. Sharp and painful, I winced just as another creature bit into thin flesh wrapped tightly around bone, until even their bites began to chip away at my skeletal self. Hurriedly, I brushed them away, only to find several suddenly crawling onto my fingers, chomping and tearing at each one. I tried to hurl them off, but by then they were on my arm, my other leg, and the saggy, fleshy bits in the middle. Everywhere they pinched, everywhere they ate, gnawing, tearing flesh, biting bone. Red welts dotted my skin, my arms flailed about, feet danced, my mouth closed and anus puckered lest they crawl through other, more vulnerable areas. Red parvi, black parvi, queens, fat ones, skinny ones, broken ones, and parvi in between. Blind, I stumbled wildly, feet falling to the more of the wicked creatures. I sickened at the squelching sounds I made. No more, no more, no more. My thigh caught against a thick branch of a moonbus. I lost my balance and tumbled into it, pink petals exploding around me, and out from the flowers emerged a strange thing. My fall had disturbed a winged warrior. A small, plump thing on thick, stumpy wings about the size of a stone and blue as a comet's tail. One side of the warrior's blue body held a sharp stinger, venomous and deadly to only the smallest percent of us among us. Its other side held large, black eyes. Eyes which loomed over me. Angry eyes. I am allergic to warrior stings. Fatally so. My father's face filled my mind. I was dragged back to the time in the field when I was left alone, foot freshly stung, dying. This winged warrior, however, hovered at my face, darting left to right, right to left. I would have been fine. Its anger would have eventually ebbed. It would have drifted away to some other pink petal. But the bites and the welts and the pains from those parvi. One tore into the fleshy bit between my thumb and finger. I screamed and swatted my hand away, shaking the creature off and infuriating the winged warrior even further. It found my face. The stinger stabbed at me. A web of pain shot through my left cheek. A soft, wet sponge of blood and guts trickled down my face as the warrior pulled that stinger out and died. It had given its life to take mine. For the second time ever, I was afraid. My body was covered with creatures meant to be beneath me. My throat tightened. I could no longer fill my lungs with air, though my eyes filled easily with tears. I wished for my father to carry me home once more. I suppose I could have gone around those black specks. I regret that now. There is more than enough asteroid for all.
In this episode of Simultaneous Times, you heard City of Joy by Weston Oakes. Music by Fog Machine. Terraformist by Jean-Paul L. Garnier, with music by Luke Poole. An Asteroid for All by Brent A. Harris, with music by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Theme music by Dane Luscombe. Out now, Simultaneous Times Volume 1, paperback science fiction anthology. Look for it at www.spacecowboybooks.com.